From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and I am in London for this final day of our coverage of Brexit this week. President Trump has injected himself into the British election and thrown British politicians through a loop. We will get to that, but we will start the hour with the politics in Washington.
And today, Congress goes on recess for a week, one day after Democrats overwhelmingly approved and Republicans overwhelmingly rejected ground rules for an impeachment inquiry of President Trump.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable, Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, and Chad Pergram of Fox News, senior Capitol Hill producer there. Welcome to both of you. And Chad, let me start with you. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi once said she would only support impeachment if it's a bipartisan effort. Today she said she wanted it to be an ironclad case. Yesterday's vote, though, was not a bipartisan effort.
She has reversed herself several times. Just the fact that they had this impeachment resolution, process resolution on the floor yesterday is significant, because just a few weeks ago, the Speaker had said that they weren't going to do it. I thought it was notable that the Speaker actually presided over the debate, the initial part of the debate, from the dais, and then presided over the end of the vote, kind of signifying her significance. She also voted. Only a few times a year do you ever have the Speaker of the House actually casting a ballot. And that kind of informed you where she was on this. You know, the problem that she created, though, is that some moderate Democrats didn't want to vote on this because they were afraid that voters, and they represent these swing and battleground districts, might conflate this vote with actual impeachment. And there was quite a back and forth I had with the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, this week, where he and Speaker Pelosi said this is not an impeachment resolution, when those of us here at the Capitol would refer to it colloquially that way. And that's because they're moderate Democrats. Although many of them, all but two, were willing to vote for this, they're afraid that these issues are going to become conflated, and it makes the politics very complicated in those 31 districts represented by Democrats that President Trump carried.
Well, Domenico, what about the politics for Republicans? Are you surprised that no Republicans supported this vote, given all of the detail that has been coming out over the last few weeks about specifically this phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine?
I haven't been surprised by that at all, and I don't know if you have been surprised by the myriad other things that Republicans have not gone or spoken out against President Trump on. It's not really been their MO. They understand the politics of this back in their districts. You know, as Chad's pointing out, the 31 districts that there's a Democrat in that President Trump won, a lot of that is because of 2018, where Democrats took back the House because they ousted many of these Republicans, a net of 40 seats. So when you're looking at moderates and where they are, the moderates and those swing districts are with Democrats on this impeachment inquiry for the most part. And who's left in the Republican Party are the people in a little bit more conservative to right-leaning districts who see the polling and understand that some 90% of Republicans still approve of the job the president is doing and back him entirely, thinking this impeachment inquiry is a sham or fraud or however they want to describe it.
And that unanimous vote, I think, by House Republicans is very important, because that was a signal, two directions. Number one, to President Trump, to demonstrate to Republicans and the president that they were standing four square behind the president. There were no cracks in the dam. And also sending a message to the Senate, where there have been some cracks in the dam, maybe not many, but saying, you know, Senate, you better represent us. You better speak in the same voice as we've been speaking here in the House of Representatives.
So that sentiment was behind perhaps the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, Doug Collins, who had this warning for Democrats.
Folks, this ain't over. Get ready. The cloud that is dropping will be dropping on their heads, because process matters and substance will always win out in the end. And this president has nothing to worry about on substance.
So, Domenico, a little bit of applause there. Domenico, Republicans insist that they're ready to start defending President Trump on substance. Have you seen that yet?
Well, I think that one thing that they need to look at is the fact that two-thirds of voters in our latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll said that it was unacceptable for the president, for any president, to ask for foreign aid in investigating a domestic political rival. So you have a majority of the country, 68% in that poll, saying that that's unacceptable. The question is whether it's impeachable. And that is a very vague, ambiguous thing. You have Republicans saying, even if there was something that was untoward there that maybe they wouldn't have done, on that it's not an impeachable offense. But that's going to be, weighed out in the court of public opinion and in Congress, in public, more so than we've seen so far over the last several weeks in the next preceding weeks coming.
And Chad, I mean, that's a fine line for Republicans to have to walk as they're defending the president, saying that something might have been wrong or unconstitutional, but may or may not be impeachable.
Right. And I talked to one senior Republican this week who indicated, and this has always been the idea, even if you read Federalist 65, where Alexander Hamilton talks about the impeachment process potentially in the Constitution. But this one senior Republican said to me, impeachment is what the House of Representatives thinks it is at any given moment. They thought that was the case with President Clinton in 1998. They certainly thought that was the case with President Nixon, Andrew Johnson. It is a moving target. It is very ill-defined in the Constitution. It's vague, and it is a political question.
Domenico, as you look at the timing of what's going to happen next, when do you expect public hearings, and when would you expect, if they do go forward with impeachment, a trial to happen in the Senate? Because we're getting very close to the Iowa caucuses.
Right. And the idea from Democrats has been that they want to do this a little bit more expeditiously than maybe if there wasn't an election calendar. Certainly, they don't want impeachment to be the thing that dominates the 2020 campaign. But let's face it, you know, President Trump is a major factor, if not the major factor, in next year's election. He's on the ballot. He was a major factor in the 2018 elections, and he wasn't on the ballot, which makes this even more heightened. And that's a fact of the matter that they are just going to have to deal with. And the fact set here are different now than in the past two impeachments in the last 50 years or so. So we are in uncharted territory where they're going to have to figure out the timeline over the next several weeks, how they're going to make the case, Democrats, to the public and to some of those wavering Republicans in the Senate. I would expect, they would hope, by the end of the year there'd be something that they vote on, but it's likely going to slide into next year.
I just want to pivot to 2020 in the few minutes that we have left. And I'm going to throw this one also to you, Domenico, which is this morning, Elizabeth Warren released her plan to pay for Medicare for all. It would require $20 trillion in federal spending. And she says not one penny in middle class tax increases. Not everyone believes that. How will it be funded? Or what more do we know about this and her strategy here?
Right. And that is her plan, to not raise taxes on middle class voters. It's a little different than Bernie Sanders' plan, who would have a little bit more of a spread the burden around. She is looking at increasing the wealth tax on people who make more than $1 billion or have more than $1 billion from 3% to 6%. Employers and corporations, their tax would go up. They'd replace essentially what they pay toward private insurance now. So those are the two main areas, an increase on taxes on the wealthy and on corporations, although some people are questioning the math, whether it would work. And, you know, frankly, there aren't the votes to pass this in the House right now, or the Senate, most likely, maybe the House because Democrats are there. But to pass the Senate, almost impossible, because you need the 60 votes necessary to overcome a filibuster. So the likelihood of any of these things passing is very dim. And these are the kinds of details that normally get worked out in the legislative process.
You know, and we're not through the primary process here yet. And look at who endorsed Bernie Sanders the past couple of weeks. Members of the squad. You had Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with Bernie Sanders. So this might be an effort by Elizabeth Warren to kind of, you know, plow some fields in that area and into the Sanders vote. You know, but this is the potential danger that some Democrats fear about nominating someone like Sanders, or maybe Warren, frankly, who seems to be, you know, vying with Joe Biden at this stage, is that she might be too far left wing, and that might not play well in the general election. You know, you need a foil, and this is exactly what President Trump would want to run against, you know, someone like Elizabeth Warren, maybe preferring Warren compared to Joe Biden. The other thing in terms of the pay for on this, Warren talks about cutting into defense spending. Right now, we spend about 53% of all discretionary dollars. They go toward the Pentagon. Another way to crunch that with some other accounts, you get up to maybe 58, 59%. And so she thinks that there's spending there that you could take away from the military to go toward that. Those in the military would say, no, absolutely not. Look, you know, we have issues in Syria. Mm-hmm. We might have issues with China. And anytime you put these issues out there, when people see a number like $24 trillion, it gives Republicans a lot of room to run down the field with that and say, we talked about how expensive the Green New Deal was. How about this plan by Senator Warren?
Just really quickly from both of you, what do you make of the New York Times Siena College poll out today on the state of the race in Iowa? Elizabeth Warren narrowly ahead of Bernie Sanders, then Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden fourth, and the other candidates in the single digits. Domenico?
This is why national polls are just kind of things that you should sort of dismiss almost altogether when it comes to the horse race, because you've seen Biden leading for most of this year, then Warren sort of tied him and eclipsed him over the last couple of weeks, and now this poll has him fourth at 17%, with Warren in first at 22, Sanders 19, Pete Buttigieg third at 18. This is a real four-person race at this point, and it's going to be really interesting to see how they get out the vote come the voting time.
And
what does a
Chad,
Senate trial
I'm sorry.
Do? What does a Senate trial do if it happens during Iowa and New Hampshire come February?
I was going to say Domenico filibustered you, Chad, so you couldn't step in, but you got it in there.
And you can't filibuster in a Senate trial.
You don't have the votes.
Domenico Montanaro at NPR and Chad Pergram at Fox News. Thanks to both of you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Here in London today, Brexit Party founder Nigel Farage tried to ramp up the pressure on Prime Minister Boris Johnson as the British general election campaign begins. Farage said his Brexit Party would run against Johnson's Conservatives across the country unless Johnson abandons his divorce deal with the European Union. Farage would be happy with a no-deal Brexit. President Trump also inserted himself into the race this week when he called Farage's radio show and also blasted Johnson's Brexit deal.
We want to do trade with UK and they want to do trade with us. And to be honest with you, this deal, under certain aspects of the deal, you can't do it.
Well, joining us now here in the studio in London is Dr. Thomas Sampson, Associate Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
First of all, you just heard President Trump there jump into the race here in the UK. How do you feel about that?
It's always interesting to kind of hear the American perspective on what's going on in the UK. But I think, you know, we can say for certain that, you know, Downing Street are not going to be very happy with this interjection of the president. Trump is extremely unpopular in the UK. And the prospect of a UK-US trade deal, which is what Trump was talking about, is also very controversial. So they're not going to welcome this.
Because one of the arguments that people who want to leave the European Union, like Boris Johnson, have been making is if we do that, we can make trade deals with everybody, including, most importantly, the United States. So if Trump says that's not going to be possible with this deal, that's a problem for Johnson.
Yeah, that's right. And it is a little hard to discern exactly what the president was talking about when he said this deal wouldn't allow for a UK-US deal. Because certainly, you know, one of the differences between this deal and Prime Minister May's deal is that the UK is going to come out of the EU's common trade policy. And that does open up the possibility that the UK can do deals with other countries like the US. Now, that doesn't mean a deal is automatic and there's still a lot of obstacles to overcome, but certainly it is possible under these terms for a deal to be done.
Do you think, though, that it is going to be harder than the people who keep saying that the UK will be able to sign all these trade deals around the world if they Brexit? Do you think that it's going to be harder than the promises that are being made right now for the UK to actually do that? We see that in the US, they still haven't signed a new NAFTA years later.
Yeah, I mean, trade deals typically are very complex, controversial negotiations that take many years. And I think that's something we're learning in the UK as we go through the kind of interminable Brexit process. And there are really two big obstacles to a deal with the US. One is that the UK's priority is going to be to get a new deal with the EU. And to a certain extent, you know, any deal with the US is going to play second fiddle to that. So it's not going to be the priority. But then there's also that the issues like food standards and drug pricing are going to be very controversial in the UK. And to the extent that that's what the US wants to get out of a deal, it's not clear that there's much scope for an agreement.
You're an expert in international trade. When you look at Brexit, what are your big concerns about it? And not just the deal that we're talking about here, but Brexit in general.
I think there's a pretty broad consensus among economists that Brexit is going to be bad for the UK economically, right? And essentially, the problem, the EU accounts for around half of the UK's trade, and leaving the EU is going to mean it's going to be harder for British firms to do business with Europe. And these new trade barriers, they just create these frictions to business that, you know, end up making us a little bit less well off. So there is a concern that it's going to kind of gradually lead to the UK being less well off.
Do you think that Europe would also be worse off after Brexit?
Yeah, for exactly the same reason, right? These barriers operate in both directions. Where there is an asymmetry, though, is that the EU accounts for a much bigger share of the UK's trade than in the other direction, because the UK is small relative to the EU. And kind of most of the analysis of this that's been done suggests that the losses to the EU are about 10 times smaller than the losses to the UK. So it's really the kind of UK stands to lose the most.
One of the things that was said in the run-up to the Brexit referendum by the Leave campaign is that the UK ends up spending so much money being a part of the EU. We didn't hear a lot about what you're talking about now, that it would actually cost the UK a lot to leave the EU.
Yeah, I think there was a kind of this message that the Leave campaign put out, you know, the 350 million on the side of the bus that they said was being sent to Brussels got a lot more attention than the kind of analysis saying, well, actually, this cost that you pay to be part of the club is worth it because the, you know, the benefits outweigh the cost. And that has been rather overlooked in the debate.
You think there'll be Brexit?
Probably, but I think making predictions about Brexit
it's
tends to lead people
to
become a fool.
Dr. Thomas Sampson, Associate Professor at the London School of Economics, thanks for coming in. And we have been speaking with members of Parliament this week. One of them is David Lammy of the Labour Party. He did not join his party's leader, Jeremy Corbyn, in supporting the early general election. He wants to stop Brexit and wants another referendum on whether the UK should leave the EU. When we talked at Parliament, I asked David Lammy whether any good has come of the Brexit process of sorting out disagreements about Europe and Britain's role in the world.
Well, we have had a debate in the last 3.5 years that we did not have in either the run-up to the referendum or indeed for the 20 years previous. Britain now has the biggest pro-European community. You saw them on the streets on the 19th of October. However, I think this has been an unedifying period. It really began with the murder of Joe Cox, a sitting MP in our country. Our country is horribly divided. It seems to have been captured by a Trumpian minority determined to drive Britain in a particular direction, taking all the tricks from Donald Trump, Steve Bannon and others. That is not a way to bring the country together. And I have to say, it is clear to me also that social media has had a role to play in this, both the result and some of the fractions that we've got at the moment. And actually, that's in the interests of countries like Russia, which are stirring the pot.
Well, when you say Trumpian, what do you mean by that? What's been Trumpian about this process?
I mean a mendacity and a lack of veracity and lies told to the electorate. I mean a pandering of immigration rhetoric, anti-immigration rhetoric, and brute racism in the population. I mean a lack of leadership on fundamental issues of democracy, civility, in an enlightened kind of mature democracy. All of that has been swept aside. That is what is Trumpian. And it's a populist nationalism. This is no joke here in the continent of Europe. It's extremely worrying. It's very, very sad that the United States has had this problem over the last few years and that it's being mimicked and copied over here and spreading around the world. And it's challenging progressive parties on how to defeat it and how to stand up for it. And I say that, of course, as an ethnic minority, a black MP, proud of my African and Caribbean heritage, but absolutely proud to be a British English Member of Parliament born in this country.
I've been traveling around the UK since we've been here and have been in the Midlands, which is a part of the country where you'll find a lot more people who are more than happy at this point to leave the European Union. Do you think that some of the frustration that people have that this process has gone on for so long may lead the UK to make a decision that may not be in its long-term best interest, but people just want to be done with it? And even those who may have voted to remain now are just ready to be done with the whole Brexit process, even if that means leaving.
On the government's own analysis, we will see a drop in growth of 8% in the Midlands and 11% in the northeast of this country. That is a bigger drop in growth than we saw during the recession that followed the 2008 crash in our economy. What we have coming to constituencies like mine in London, a traditionally black constituency, like a sort of area of New York, like Harlem or the Bronx, I'm afraid is the kind of poverty that we see in parts of downtown America. And what we've got coming to places like the East Midlands and the Northeast is the kind of poverty and despair that you see in parts of the Rust Belt. That is what this government are importing to this country. And they're doing it because, yes, if you're moving money around and you're into the sovereign wealth fund business, you're going to make a lot of money. And there are a lot of conservatives like Jacob Rees-Mogg who will benefit from this chaos. But let's be absolutely clear. The ordinary people who've been sold a pup by populist nationalists, told that this is because of immigrants, that immigration will come down, will now found, one, that immigration won't come down, because when we go to do a trade deal with India and the Chinese, they will get the visas they want, and actually immigration will rise. But worse than that, the manufacturing that is the heart of the northern parts of this country will disappear. The car manufacturers will go because they will now be paying tariffs between our country and the European Union. Things will get pricier and jobs will be cut as a result. So I'm afraid the future is very, very bleak for the sorts of parts of the country that I'm deeply concerned about, working people and how they provide for their families over the months and years ahead.
Let me finally ask you a question that has nothing to do with Brexit, because we've talked to you a number of times on the show. I know that you lived in the United States for some time in your life in both Boston and San Francisco. When I come to London, one of the first things that I have to do is have great Indian food, because it's the best I've ever had. When you go to the United States, what's the first thing that you like to do that you can't get here?
I find the best diner in town. Now that's not usually a big fancy name. It's right. A quiet diner where you can get a great burger and fries, where you're sort of sitting at the tabletop, and you know, that's what I look out for when I'm in the States.
Well, next time you come to the States, we'll take you out for a burger and fries at a good diner. David Lammy, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Lammy, a Labor Member of Parliament. We've been speaking with others as well. You can find all our coverage at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
1969 saw lots of major events. Apollo 11 landed on the moon. It was the year the U.S. began bombing Cambodia, and the year the Woodstock Music Festival took place. Something major happened in Mexico City, too, and is still significant today. The subway system opened there. The STC is one of the largest metro systems in the world and also one of the most peculiar. KJZZ's Rodrigo Cervantes reports on how this public transportation system is also one of the largest cultural centers in Mexico.
Every day, 5.5 million people ride Mexico City's subway with its 195 stations and 140 miles of tracks. And as you walk into one of its stations, you discover a karaoke and a public piano inviting you to sing or play a song. Paulina Contreras is a music student, and today she's practicing a Coldplay tune.
Muy bien, porque así la gente explota su talento. Pero nada más siento que hace falta más.
Contreras says the subway piano is great for people who want to show their talents. And this is just one out of hundreds of cultural experiences in Mexico City's metro. Vanessa Bohorquez is the subway coordinator of cultural activities. We meet at the Metro Museum, which opened 2 years ago to preserve the history of a subway while hosting temporary exhibits.
muchas veces ha sido denominado el museo más grande de la ciudad.
Borges says the entire subway could be considered Mexico City's largest museum, with more than 30 murals, dozens of sculptures, museums, libraries, a planetarium, a movie theater, and even a pyramid.
Y es el adoratorio de Hecatl.
The temple of the Aztec god of the wind is in the Pino Suárez station. It was uncovered during the subway's excavation. And Borges says it's the most visited archaeological site in Mexico, with 24 million people passing through every year. And almost every day, there's also live acts like this one. That's the popular rock band El Tri, playing a classic love song set, no wonder, at a metro station. Borges says the subway's cultural offerings not only embellish the city, but also help bring a friendlier, more peaceful environment to the urban chaos. Borges says most of his activities are privately funded, so thanks to that, the price admission is a metro ticket, which costs roughly 25 cents. And in two stations in downtown Mexico City, the metro just opened two art galleries. One of them displays the works of 300 international artists on a 200,000 square foot area. Noemi Martinez walks through the other gallery, a pedestrian tunnel covered with screens for a video art installation.
Ay, muy bonita.
She says the exhibit is beautiful. It mixes sounds, nature landscapes, and wildlife with abstract animations.
Que la vida es muy apresurada. Esto te ayuda a pensar a...
Martinez says our lives are so fast-paced, but the metro's art displays help us stop and think about what's truly important, like preserving and enjoying nature and art. For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
Partisan political animosity in the U.S. has affected how we speak. It shaped how politicians describe their opponents and the way we talk about divisive social issues. Take the matter of rampant gun violence. Political leaders routinely respond to mass shootings around the country by expressing their dismay, saying their thoughts and prayers are with the victims and families. The term thoughts and prayers may express sympathy and profound sorrow, but to the ears of our next guest, it's lost its meaning. Alyssa Quart has called her newest book, Thoughts and Prayers. Quart is a writer of nonfiction books, including Squeezed, and she's the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She's also a poet and believes the language of poetry can make us see things we've grown weary of in a new way. Alyssa, the term thoughts and prayers, I wonder how this became your starting point.
To me, the problem with it is it's become emptied out of meaning. And one of the things I was trying to do by writing a poem called Thoughts and Prayers and then titling this collection that is to, in some sense, reclaim the phrase thoughts and prayers. It's not just to say this is empty or ironic. It's to say poems are thoughts and prayers and all of our political will has an element of thoughts and prayers. Why are these phrases being misused and twisted and emptied out? Let's try to reclaim their value.
So how do you reframe the phrase and take back the phrase, like thoughts and prayers, through your poetry? And you can read, in fact, this particular poem. You say it's composed of the public statements around mourning over school shootings from political leaders and websites. Do you want to read a bit of it?
Absolutely. So thoughts and prayers, designed and executed, us gun owners, our thoughts, our team's banner, our assault style, thoughts and hashtag pray for, and I'm going to skip towards the end, all impacted by last night's despicable, armed teachers, relatives affected, the thoughts and prayers stamp, the thoughts and prayers handcrafted wood card, the thoughts and prayers angel pin, hashtag pray for, my heart is with Parkland, my heart is running down the hall, shooting our prayers.
So that, again, is some of the public statements that have been made. And when you convert them to a poem, what do you think the power is that they gain to change the jargon?
What I think what can happen when we intertwine politics, public life, and poetry is to create works that vault over this conventional language. And what I'm seeing, even with some of the candidates in the presidential election this season, is I'm seeing them draw on repetition and other kinds of poetic language to make their point. You know, Senator Warren is using repetition and these kind of folksy refrain, getting away from the dehydrated language of, you know, the new rhetoric of politics where the American people is a constant.
In the op-ed that you did for the New York Times, you wrote, quote, if the language we hear on television broadcasts no longer stirs us to do anything more than tweet our dismay, poetry can express something new or something old in a new way, and this can energize us to take action. Poetry's wordplay can combat cliches and receive wisdom. So when you are writing a book like this, how did you take something that has become a cliche and reframe it?
Well, I mean, Thoughts and Prayers is one example. I also took the language of harassment, of a harassment apology, and I put that into a poem called The Harasser's Apology. It's Harvey Weinstein, Louis C.K., Kevin Spacey, et cetera, because I noticed this strange commonality in the words they were using. And when I recombined their phrases and cut them up and jammed them, there was a strange formal ingenuity that here, why don't I read it? It's called The Harasser's Apology. I always felt I was pursuing shared feelings. I am suffering the same treatment. A wake-up call. I wish I had reacted to their admiration of me. Conquer my demons. I wielded that power. I came of age when all the rules, different script. I was mistaken. I've brought anguish and hardship as a man. This story has encouraged me to address other things. A good example to them. Wake up. I believe tampering has occurred. I am sorry for the feelings he describes having carried. I moved on her like a b-. I so respect all women. And so one of the things with this recombination or refreshing of these often banal phrases is you can see the impulses under them more clearly, and you can see the commonalities of the apology as a form and what it's missing. You know, one of the people get called out for these apologies now, and sometimes they think too much so. But one of the things when you go over these newspaper accounts and you turn them into poetry as a poet or as a reader too, you can start to read between the lines, I guess. And that's the goal of this kind of poetry.
The benefit in taking them out of context.
Exactly.
This is a very interesting thing that you're working on now, because you're a reporter and you're a writer and you're a poet, and the book represents that hybrid, because as you wrote some of these poems, you first did some reporting. I mean, going out and taking notes and getting quotes and doing the things you would do as if you were writing a newspaper or a magazine story, and then added some of your own reactions to that poetry. So this is, you call this reported poetry or documentary poetry?
Yeah, documentary poetry. And it has a history. It started, you could say, in the 30s when you had poets like Charles Reznikoff and Muriel Rukeyser going to the mines in West Virginia or using legal testimony and creating poems out of that. And that was a moment not unlike ours of political despair and income inequality. So I think it's telling in some ways that that's what these poets felt they needed to do in that time. So here's an example of reported poetry. It's called Ventura, and it's about income inequality in California. Organizers may organize closets or workers. One stacks the canvas boxes of the rich. The other canvasses people. Gardeners blow leaves they just blew, plum trees they've already pruned. The elders pick the field's acrid berries. Their sons arrive out of season, sleep in the street, in a doghouse, in someone's car. Oxnard strawberries are plucked by hand. No union, T visas, U visas, La Migra, on the same road as the Jodes. And it ends. Money, the phantom limb, have they kept our interest?
Some of the poetry here, it's not all political. I mean, it all has a message, but some of it is quite humorous as well. As for a poet like you, when you take this approach to your writing. Is it a release? Do you feel something different as you write it and complete it than you would otherwise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it feels cathartic, I guess. I still try to make things factual, and I abide by the laws of journalism, the ethics of journalism, but I feel like I can use a little less restraint. I have an alphabetical poem where I'm looking at the alphabet of the Trump era with things like ICE is letter I, and other letters stand in for other parts of our modern experience here. P is for payday lenders, you know. K is for kale eaters. Micropolitics eat microgreens. I can have a little fun. And yeah, I wrote about a mammogram, having a mammogram. And the point of it, I mean, mammograms are not fun, but, you know, I got to talk about Philip Roth in a poem, in a humorous feminist poem. And that's the approach, to try to write poetry also about things that people don't usually write about. And breastfeeding and going to a store called the Upper Breast Side, which actually exists
in New York.
And, you know, so I think some of this is reclaiming what is poetic or what is available for poetry. And that could be political, but it also could be the personal that is political.
Alyssa Court is the head of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her newest book of reported poetry is called Thoughts and Prayers. You can find a link to some of her poetry at hereandnow.org. Alyssa Court, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
As you know, if you're a regular listener, we talk with BBC political correspondent Rob Watson all the time. But this is the first time that I've actually seen him in person. Rob,
well,
you're real.
Well, we shake hands across the desk. There you are. If this was TV, you could see it.
It is so great to see you in person. And first of all, thank you for all that you do for our show every day.
It's a total pleasure. As you know, I lived in the United States for a long time. And if it hadn't been for public radio, I don't know what I would have done.
Why do you think that Brexit matters to the United States?
Why does it matter to the United States? Well, if we talk about the old-fashioned kind of consensus in the United States, so before Donald Trump, the previous view of most American governments since the end of the Second World War is, what did they want in the United Kingdom? They wanted this nice, peaceful, stable place. You know, the place that had the Queen and the rubbish food and crazy weather. But, you know, they were reliable. They were a reliable ally. They were reliable economically. And, of course, most importantly, they were America's kind of voice in the European Union. We were a sort of bridge between Washington and Brussels.
A force of stability. They've got a stiff upper lip. They know what they want.
All of that stuff. And I suspect that after the Trump administration, that will continue to be that the view of future American administrations. That's what they would have wanted. I mean, Donald Trump has been different in the sense that he has completely thrown 60 years of U.S. foreign policy up in the air by encouraging Brexit. I mean, no one will ever forget, you know, the sort of Kissinger line on all of this, which is, you know, when you want Europe, what number do you call? So the United States had wanted Britain in the European Union as that sort of bridge.
Well, and especially with the rise right now of certainly China, and you could also say Russia, to have a Europe that may be a little weaker and a UK that may be a little weaker matters because of just the world order and power.
Absolutely. I mean, again, all U.S. administrations, Republican, Democrat, all the sort of what you would call, which I remember from my time in Washington, that sort of, I don't know, the sort of foreign service, the foreign policy infrastructure of Washington, they would just look at this and say, this is nuts. You know, what on earth is Britain doing? It's ruining its standing in the world. It's threatening its economic well-being, and is looking less reliable to us as an ally. Now, of course, the Trump administration's view, and it seems to me this is what's going to happen of a necessity if Britain definitely does leave the European Union. It seems to me that Brexit must of a necessity involve a pivot away from Brussels to Washington for the UK. And I guess perhaps under future presidents, that'll be something that's more comfortable for British people than a pivot to a Washington dominated by President Trump.
Let me just pull back the curtain a little bit on you, Rob. And you, as I've seen since I've been here, are on TV all the time on different channels. When a huge story breaks and you've got to satisfy all these different parts of the BBC all around the world, what do you have to do first? Do you have to do the domestic audience first, or do you go straight to the World Service, or what do you do?
That's easy, actually. I text or email my wife to say I'm going to be late. My responsibility is mainly actually to describe what's happening in Britain to people who consume the BBC overseas. So I don't have so much of that, and in many ways that makes my job a lot easier because I'm reporting on the UK in the same way all those years that I lived in the United States. I reported on the US as a foreign correspondent, you know, trying to get that little bit of distance. I try to do that now. And I do think it's an easier job because my domestic colleagues, you know, they get criticized a vast amount. I mean, I think a lot of people who voted Remain think that the BBC had kind of lost the plot and that it's been far too kind of gentle on Brexit. And you wouldn't be surprised to hear that a lot of people who voted Leave think, you know, that the BBC is a hotbed of metropolitan elite Remainers.
Do you get bored of covering Brexit?
So I'm wondering whether this is wise to let this metaphor out that I use at dinner parties. What the hell? Go for it. Why not? So I sometimes describe in more intimate, non-on-the-air surroundings. I liken Brexit to a bad opera. And you say, what do you mean by a bad opera, Rob? Well, you know, a good opera has great tunes, you know, these enormous characters and a kind of almighty ending, right? I mean, that's what we like about opera. But it seems to me that Brexit, the arias, the songs, by which I mean the arguments, are rubbish in the sense that we've heard them all so many times, so we're all really bored of the same tune, the same arguments. The characters, well, I'm not sure that any of the main characters involved in this would really make it into the British Hall of Greats in terms of political history. So that means all we're waiting for is this dramatic ending. And I don't think that's going to happen, right? I mean, I just think that we are going to carry on talking about our relationship with the European Union forever and a day. So no good tunes, no astonishingly kind of consumptive kind of heroine who dies flat on the floor, and no dramatic ending.
That is the BBC's political correspondent and apparently opera correspondent as well, Rob Watson. Great to talk to you in person.
Great to meet, and great to see you, Jeremy. We'll shake hands again.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks.
And we want to say thanks to everyone here at the BBC who helped us with our Brexit broadcast this week. It is a big list. After all, there are around 6,000 people in the building that I'm sitting in right now. We want to single out Peter Ross, Carrie Alexandra, Sarah Hawkins, Barry Byrne, Paul Mason, Derek Clark, and Phil Bull. Thanks also to Frankie Paris, Mike Moschetto, and James Trout on the Here and Now staff, Peter O'Dowd in Berlin, and Alex Ashlock here in London. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association, and today we really mean in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.